covered him with a wet suit and bag and thunder. And
where I got that was out of that Wall Street Journal guy. So you covered him with moss,
most certainly, and absolutely wet. When I wrung out the wet sleeping bag, and covered him with that.
How'd you get the sleeping bag?
Get tossed up out of the wreck.
Chapter 23 is the Machiko Sakita thing. See, there's a chapter missing. This only goes to chapter 22, though.
Yeah, I just wonder what the wrap-up was going to be.
Chapter 23, a whole chapter on Machiko Sakita.
Uh-huh.
That comes before the conclusion. You're thinking of the conclusion.
Well, I just read to the end, but I knew that you had another chapter, but I didn't know how you'd
going
okay. to wrap it up.
That, you read the conclusion, and there are little short shots in it. See? But, you know, then we're kind of unwinding the reader, see? We're giving them a last shot in the arm, little things, see, that we hate to, we don't want to leave out. See, we're just telling them, and then it goes into conclusion. But 23 is the Machiko Sakita. 22 doesn't have any little spurious incidents.
The tail end there has some.
But that's the conclusion.
Oh, it is?
Sure.
Well, I read the end at the end, but
no, I know what you mean. I know what's confusing. Look here. Here, Lord, right here. Insert chapter 23. This is the end of chapter 22,
well,
right
that
here.
That is the end, then.
It isn't. Insert it.
No.
We haven't got 23 written. It's sitting right out there in a poster right now.
Mm-hmm.
Insert chapter 23, entitled Michiko Sakita.
Uh-huh.
Complete and highly detailed description of the incident with a statement by Race, Rage, and Abe. Okay, now, here, conclusion.
Yeah.
This, the chapter 23 goes right in here.
Yeah, okay.
This is
that
where your
is
spurious incidents are.
Yeah. Is that good?
Well, what's wrong with it?
This
is after Machiko Sakita.
Yeah, but you've got tremendous wallop in
it. Oh, it's just like a...
You got to have a conclusion down to the book.
There's a couple of pages separating it, and some people don't even read the conclusion.
That's right.
You
see what it does.
Like footnotes and stuff like that.
What it does, it kind of lets the reader down. In other words, he's had a delightful time and he read through this thing, ending with a very dramatic incident. And then you kind of come back to it. You've had a pleasant experience. You don't want to leave a guy hanging in midair at the end of this Machiko Sakita thing. Oh, God, no.
I was wondering the strategy, maybe. Well, you'll see.
Let's wait with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Until we get the next rewrite back, you know, and then we can, you know, if it looks like you want it, then we'll give it a go. That's no problem. But they do want a conclusion, and a conclusion and an introduction makes the book read a lot better. And it ties it all together. You gotta bring people from 72 to the present. And that's all the conclusion is supposed to do. And pretty quick too. That's right. It's an epilogue book. It wouldn't even have to be a conclusion if you just call it an epilogue. Well, that sets it apart. It's not even part of the book. So it's just a
getting back to the epilogue or whatever your conclusion is there, you know, I think and you mentioned about now, which is great. See, I got a good punchline for the mountain now. And this is, during the 9-year survey, I had in the back of my mind, during these 9-10 years, that took place to locate an ideal ski location. Now, one that was readily accessible, that had perennial landing conditions, one that had beautiful powder snow all summer, except in the late afternoon when it turned out flush, and one place with a striking view. This is the most important of any approach of a camp. Now you've got all these requirements. Number one, in your most important order. Perennial landing spot, that's most important, right? Number two, but of a great, and very little, very small amount of lesser importance would be a view. What is the best view of McKinley? That spectacular Southeast approach with the composition of great hanging glaciers and sculptured granite and spires that disappear into the haze. This is the most spectacular view. Okay, that's two requirements, all right? Now the third one would be, of course, the availability of the snow, which you have since it's on the north side. I mean, so with just three rough requirements there, you cover the whole field, and you got the thing case. Now, find it. Okay? So, during the survey and after the survey, I looked for it. And I had five locations. And it wasn't happenstance proposition that I picked out this southeast approach, the amphitheater, the Great Gorge, the Ruth Glacier. A tremendous, a breathtaking place, racked up against Mount Huntington, a spire like none other in all Alaska or anywhere else, short of the Himalayas. And the most spectacular scenery of the East Buttress, Mount Silverthorne, and the amphitheater is one tremendous deal. The coach from the U.S. Olympics and American Alpine even rolled in the snow up there last August because it's a beautiful corner of snow, the last part of August. Beautiful. They got 50 troops trained for the U.S. Olympics, American Alpine. American Alpine is a superior American U.S. Olympics. They trained the best troops in the nation for the U.S. Olympics. They got 50 athletes and 20 trainers, and they want a place for them. Menicky, the bankroll, the great godfather of the U.S. Olympics, this puts out the heavy gold that makes the U.S. Olympic gold. Made three trips up here specifically to go up to the mountain house, but he never had the nerve for the last trip, and we loaded him in the airplane and said, let's go. So with Balapon on one side and Shepard, the great ski coach, on the other side, we take Beneke to the 6,000 foot level, and he's awestricken, but that's easy for him. you don't have to have any excuses for any reservations for a multi-million area. But he's cocoony and touchy and nervous and afraid of ice holes. The place is late. Within a mile and a half with the most spectacular crevasses in the world. He's terrified. And he said that he loved the snow. The scenery was magnificent, but he didn't want to lose any of these beautiful people in the ice hole. Well, I told him he had about 5 square miles there when you didn't have to get close to any of these tremendous ice holes, pressure ridges, crevasses, therefore the things that bother him. But it would be seen whether the coast is over far.
Yeah,
the bankers.
But what should have done when you go up there and land, like say you take later and I'll
take like,
well, okay, but if you just get out of the airplane, you get a safe right up to your eyeball.
We hardly weren't as cold as
we okay, you get out and you need snowshoes going up?
Oh,
okay.
And,
get out of the airplane and you get your snowshoes out and put them on, and then you walk over the mountain.
So I'll rope up and go right with you. With that, you can see it. I'll help you with support there. I wanted to mention here that I feel it in April 67. In the fall of 70, cyclone wind moved it.
Yeah, I remember that.
The building weighs 10,000 tons now. One of the Whipperville tenants.
Yeah.
It's like my new
Robert. And you had a crew up there the next year.
Right, and year we put the Peace Corps worker from New Powell, who was an engineer, by the way, and he put a rock foundation under the police guy. Furthermore, we put 5 coats of dark oak stain on the building. And
were those guys went up to really tie it down again after the
Well, that was Dave Johnson's group, Spears, 7 of them. And also, I attached eye bolts to all 6 corners. And I've been trying to get a jackhammer. Now I'll have to wait for next spring, or next July, to find a rock again. And then I want a jackhammer, eye bolt, and turnbuckle, and chain. Building down, so but it's in position now, and then of course I'll mortar this fine rock job together with quick set tough cement special stuff ground we have.
Right now it's not anchored down.
Not anchored down, but the 10,000 tons of it sits like in the cup of your hand. But what I wanted to say in a demonstration of the
this old night I hear. Old lady's over there listening to all this. She thinks if we go up there, the big wind is going to hit. You know.
He told me it was anchored down already.
Well, I was.
Okay. But what I wanted to say, if you said just one word about the mountain house, or one long sentence, you could say most spectacular view of the whole Alaska Range. Plus, it's the only place in the world where the ladies can step out the powder room and fall 6,000 feet.
Yeah.
See? This is what I'd like for you to maybe incorporate.
Okay. Right on the page, do it again.
I hope to initiate the annual ski party up there again. I've got a 14-man crew that just rode in a big 16-cylinder ladder yesterday. And I'd like to keep somebody up there steady all throughout the summer.
Yeah.
You know,
So the definition of the
expert, one, it shoots it down.
Yeah. The definition of the expert is a local boy away from home.
Yeah. But that couldn't apply to me because I'm in my own backyard and I don't believe in experts anyway.
Right.
Anyway, we're just paying interest to the bank. It soothes the ones with their hackles and the rest of them listen more closely. Then you can tell them about something about it. But there's some of the tales go over a whole lot better than others. You know, there's very few doctors that have them at some time or other. They know cards, they know dice. A sailor knows dice. If you my God, it's a sailor's in the crowd that got it made. But if you can talk to them about what they're interested in, never mind telling them a whole bunch of jazz they're not interested in.
Doctors are supposed to be the first pilots in the world.
Oh, they're preoccupied. Oh man, no good. And that's what they say.
Boy, that won't bother me. I don't know enough. Yeah. Float along, you know, huh? Fun.
Yeah.
That's about as far as I go, you know.
Yeah.
I know not to worry about that.
In regards to page 2 of chapter 8, I think I must have written that or something top of page. Now we landed on a sandbar that Washburn and this is not so. Great eagle-eyed Washburn sees all and knows all, and that's not an overstatement. And where we landed through was on an unimproved bit of a sandbar, but we carefully cased the thing out, and I made sure that that's where he wanted to land before I landed on it, because it was hairy.
There again, I was
and
trying
short.
To emphasize, you know, the fact that these sandbar strips, man, I've been there myself last time. You gave it to where, you know, I had to get it down.
Well, that,
you know, when on
yeah.
the feet, you know, you'll find a spot, swing around, and go back to it, and you'll overfly it a couple of times. But, yeah, if I can see where he's going to land.
Yeah,
the third time around, he'll set it up, pull on flaps, and slow it down, and boy, you can see the sandbars come at you, and all at once he's down. He's going to be where he's going. But
yeah.
Washburn, of course. The thing that I didn't realize, Don, at that point when I wrote
Washburn's
that.
Washburn's a pilot.
Right. And I didn't realize that when I wrote that. I realized it later on. So I wouldn't have written that.
That was a fraction of page 3, chapter 8. No copy of page 3.
Okay. We'll get it. This is going to make this rewrite pretty easy.
Yeah.
There's not too much. I still got to do battle with that. She goes,
now on page 4, top of page, chapter 8, this proposition here, friendship, which was conceived, is a shared love of high places, nurtured and deep providing mutual respect. Well, maybe so, but wouldn't it be better? See, I hadn't really sized him up for about 9 years before I thought, boy, you're the real guy.
In other words, you
well, you know, because it's like,
okay, now remember,
let me tell you something. It takes a long while to really get to know his name. Now, the reason is that he's multilingual in a lot of languages. And he don't always say what he thinks. And when he says something, he's 9 times out of 10 pulling your leg anyway. And it just takes a while to figure it out. And everybody, he's a high powered guy. And on the description of it here, someplace, you've got him mislabeled as kind of a recessive or congenial type. Listen. Boy, there's a wolverine in tiger's clothing. And he's not to be confused with anything mild He's just like a don't solve that guy. Except, I mean, he's violent. He is,
powerful?
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
Look, he is not, just innate, like an object, a vegetable or something. He's pure tiger.
I didn't realize I described him that way.
Ooh! Ah!
I didn't realize I described him that way. I said he was humane.
Well, not necessarily. What about, if he looks a guy in the eye, and if the guy could possibly make it another 100 yards, he punches him in the pants with an ice axe to get him that other 100 yards. If the guy still has the light in his eye, he beats him some liver pill. If he gets another half a mile and still has the light in his eye, he gets a couple more liver pills. If it lightens up anymore, he drags him to the summit. You call this guy gentle? Hell no.
Humane isn't gentle.
Well, he's not necessarily human either.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
now, wait a minute. He's got all kinds of facts.
Right. He's a humane guy. He's a guy who understands people.
Yeah, but you should.
That's what humane means.
So there's many meanings to humane.
No.
But listen. Now, I've seen he's in stature, he's quite small. Now, even with a big park on, he's still quite small. So some of these great athletes come on and climb and say, this guy's going to show us a way up the mountain and all that.
Forget about the mountain for the time being, though. Think of Ray Gené sitting in his cabin eating a piece of liver side.
Oh, yeah, well, that's his best Sunday.
When Ida and I went over there with him, and we know Ray, we know Marlene. Marlene's a good friend of ours.
Right.
And we sat him down, and we had a good laugh. I ought to play that tape for you.
Yeah, I know.
Everybody was at ease. He wasn't putting on a Sunday day.
No. Listen, but you can't know a guy as complicated as Gené in one liver sauce.
No.
No, never make it. You've got to see
how
stress.
How would you describe it in one word?
Huh? Humane?
How would you describe
wrong
it?
Word.
Give me another word.
Well, you've got to see him in all these various facets. You've got to see him under stress. You've got to see him mad. You have to see him happy, which is a rare streak of sunshine. He's rarely happy. But he's a good guy. I didn't say he was.
Why is he good?
Who knows? Why is anybody
anything? You think he's a good guy?
Well, I know.
Basically, how come? I mean, how come you think he's a good guy?
Well, he's talented, and
so is Cary Grant.
Well,
you would describe him as a good guy.
That's right, a good guy. He's no snob. Well, and he's a powerful thing. You've got to respect a guy that's three times as strong as an ordinary man. If you don't think so, go check the score cage test.
Suppose you were laying up on a glacier up there sometime.
Listen, why do you think I get him to go along? He's resourceful. Jeez, he's got a world of resource. And he's smart. Listen, it takes everything to get 20-some people on a traverse over the top of a given, especially a guy that you're feeding lemon drops for 8 weeks. That's a nutrient, not on health food. And you're feeding him lemon drops for 4 days.
Look at that. The word humane means that he's a guy who understands people. And I think Ray does understand.
He
understands how many liver pills he can afford to give this guy before he hits him between the eyes and the right side. He understands
the spot for the eye time.
Right. But he understands. Look, let me indulge myself to that extent, see? I know, I mean, that's me talking. That's not you saying that. That's me. People who read that, they know that I'm the guy who's saying that, in my estimation, one of Ray's best characteristics is that he's humane. He understands.
Well, he sure
people.
Is. Listen, understands I have people. Never said, Gené, let's go get this body. Let's go get these lost people. Let's go get see if we can find that wrecked airplane. Let's do this, that, or the other thing. He puts it ahead of all else to try to help somebody. That's one of the main reasons I like him.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's sort of backslash humane.
That's
really.
Humane.
Yeah. And you
right
get...
down to the city.
That's right.
You get mad enough at him to gut shoot him.
You know, all right, sure. But look at Remember one time I was down there, first started school. I didn't know Ray at all, and I probably still don't know him, really. But you can cite a guy's one of his characteristics without knowing him for years. You know. And that's the same thing that I was getting at here when I said that your friendship and a mutual love of high place was conceived when you took him in there. It was, huh? That's when you started to get to know him.
Yeah, but this is not your language. This is getting back to the English made man stuff.
All right, we'll change the wording.
Yeah, let's put some rum cup in it. It's not conceived. My God, what is this? Horse ranch?
She was a pretty good word.
Yeah,
you know just what it means, boy, when you hear it, don't you?
No.
What would you say?
People is out of places, yum, yum, yum.
Is that right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
All right, we'll change it. Go ahead.
Yeah.
It's a word that I use in my vocabulary, you know. And it is, Don, really. Conceived is not really a thing, you know. He conceived the idea of putting up a mountain. He'd not do that. What would you say? He thought about it? Thought of it? Well, suddenly you got a light one on. And you admit it and you say it. Conceived means the first inkling.
Well, I know what it means.
First inkling. And I think you did have that. You're shooting around out there the first time you met him. You listened to him talk about the glacier and the survey and stuff. You had a glimmer that he was... that he was kind of a guy that you'd be interested in more and more about, didn't you?
Listen, when he said there's $100 a landing,
okay,
in those glaciers, my ears stood up 2 feet.
All right.
I wasn't interested in conceiving any ideas other than making a random five-wheel truck to haul the $100 bill to the bank.
Well, you want me to write it that way?
Well, certainly.
In other words, the only thing you gave a damn about with regard to Waterford
was
$100 a landing?
Huh.
I mean,
this
was
the bait.
I got that in there. In those words, this is the bait.
You do?
Sure.
Okay, is that the name of this chapter, the bait?
No.
Why not?
What is it?
Yeah,
no
but, anyway.
It's in there, man. I took that right off the bait.
Yeah, good.
Washington had some good bait to offer. $100 for landing. I got that right.
Chapter name, the bait. Because if you're going to catch a skunk, you've got to have some bait, right?
Okay. Now, this is the one we're changing. In other words, we're changing the man from Boston to the bait.
Yeah. That's got stuff on it.
Okay.
Because, in order to catch a wolf, you got to be smarter than the wolf. Do you read Oscar Vogel's stuff? I mean,
I've read something that I've read.
In the last part of that's some paper considered himself a world expert.
Oh, Vogel, a guy, a potato farmer out here?
No. The ex-trapper of the Iron Mountains for 45 years. One of the few guys that ever made $10,000 in 3 months trapping.
Well, this guy's name is Vogel.
Oscar Vogel. He fences to people like Haber to claim they're world experts on a couple of things begins to next. Well, Haber isn't as bad as some of them. There's some other guy writes him that makes all bunk guesses. And man, if Bowie could tell him off and rebut him.
Well, Carly Pollock, you know that book, Never Cry Wolf? Good book. He made a study of wolves in Canada. And that thing went up to a whole host. A whole book.
Bull was great too. This particular guy that's always moaning and groaning about the various. When he called an early halt to the landings of the morning, he had a revision of plans. And
he made
a
fishing landing
before lunch. Yeah. I knew that the revision would have to do with the landing because I was making dumb a landing. And
the 1400
band of Boston Museum of Science is going to go broke.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, great. Here. See, in 1964, in the early spring, I brought the Union Oil bulk plant to Calcutta. It was a 40,000 gallon bulk capacity and a 4,000 gallon case and can capacity. Okay, that's one operation. Another side effect was a riverboat operation, two riverboats, an airboat and an inboard outboard Starfire jet. This is the second minor operation. Okay, now the third one was a Tasty Freeze ice cream stand. One morning, in about 40 minutes, while I was trying to mow the front lawn, they pushed the road through the prior week, and there was cars lined up for 2 blocks on the dusty road, and I made $67.50 while I was trying to mow the front lawn, and I only got 3 passes made on the lawn. Now this is the third operation. Now the fourth operation is the main one. Now 6 airplanes and 3 pilots. Now if you think that wasn't a Chinese program. So Roberta says, "My God, who does your bookkeeping?" Well, now in the description of Roberta, here's something, a punchline I want you to get. See, in the early part when I met Roberta on several occasions, and then later at the, on a trip to the UBs and the Reeve House, she's a great joker. And you have to really get up the moment to get ahead of it. So I said, "Oh man, a secretary, do I?" You say, and blew my nose on the windshield. Well, this is vague, but it's such a delicate problem to explain.
Yeah.
The thing was, I had a slight sniffles with a runny nose at the time. The velocity of the turns.
Yeah, right.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
The high G-force of the turns and the snot, using the term loosely,
yeah, right,
just splattered on the windshield. So you can imagine, there must have been a 6-7 G turn there to do that.
Okay.
But if you want, you can't say that in the
sure
book.
Sure you can. That's
well,
the great part about writing the data.
Well, here's,
you know,
guys, modesty.
But
the thing was, what would I think if you come out and said
that
the G-forces, I actually took time out to smile at my predicament. Lucky, I wanted to tell you that I just finished in 47 a course in acrobatics. That includes everything. That's slow rolls, snap rolls, 8-point slow rolls, man, where you crank it over at 4 increments.
Aileron turn.
Not a true aileron turn. It's a barrel roll. It's where you roll the plane
continuous
about turn, the axis, and you continue in your original direction. Now, a 4-point slow roll is where you split the circle in 4 pieces. An 8-point slow roll is where you split it in 8 pieces, and that's hard to do. Because what happens when you recover, you have to push your stick forward, use opposite control. This is where I believe that background helped me a whole $1 million.
I've heard a lot of guys say that.
Yeah, because when you're upside down and you're hopefully several thousand feet high, you get a different perspective if you know acrobatics.
Yeah, right.
Now, I knew what was going on as soon as that wing started tearing loose and started folding behind me. And I thought, man, am I going to be in for a ride? And at this time, I got the nose down because, man, there was no way to hold that thing parallel with the relative air, that is, in level flight, because one wing had
the
normal lift,
things.
The other had no lift. One was washed in properly, the other was washed out improperly, and it was folding. No, and the moments of force was unbelievable. So I pointed her straight down. The reason you point anything straight down is because that is your zero angle of lift.
Right.
You can stop the rotation. I know that. Anybody that ever did any acrobatics knows that. But you only have 2,000 feet and you're going to come to the ground. And you're going to reach the terminal velocity if you don't get the throttle and the power off. And it isn't as though you sit there
say, my God, what's going to happen next?
Right.
You try to correct as best you can, and needless to say, you've got to hold all these things. You've got to hold the wheel, the throttle, and anything else you can grab, especially in these high G turns. But if you could, you might get a good punchline out of that. If you could frame it in such a way, I told you what happened, that G-forces just from centrifugal force just blew my nose all over the windshield. From centrifugal force, tremendous G-forces.
Where did you take this aerobatics course?
Scorchy Monroe, Williamsport, Pennsylvania, in a PT-19, a plywood airplane with a low wing.
How long did it do?
Oh, 6 hours.
This was about the time when you were getting ready to bunch it with Piper.
Yeah. There was no point in sitting around Piper.
I don't have that book.
Until I came.
That's important.
Oh, yeah. It is important because in unusual attitudes.
Right.
See, look.
A pilot reading it.
The thing is, see, you want to, at your first opportunity, later on, get one of these Sitavrias and take a little acrobatics. Because I'll tell you what, in unusual attitudes, you can recover, man, just like that. And it helps you in instrument flight, too. Because, you see, another thing. Look here now. We've been talking about reverse control forces. All right, boy, if you ever needed to know about that, you need to know about it, even doing a slow roll. All right, in relation to the airplane, there's one difference. When you're inverted, the controls still work the same, but you're upside down. Therefore, you work the controls backwards, right? Now, that big resume on backwards controls is wind velocity is less than your flying speed. The controls in relation to the airplane work the same. The controls in relation to the relative wind are working backwards because the wind is overtaking the airplane. So much for that. Now, I don't want to get off on that. But I did want to say that in acrobatics, you must have some acrobatics. If you get into an inverted spin, now these little 150s, even with the limited elevator control on your Cherokee, you can still, I'll bet you, get into an inverted spin.
Yeah, you can work.
Well, sure, you can.
It's pretty tough to spin, though. So.
Hey, that's right, because of the limited elevator travel. Well, until you get your nose high enough, you can't get that 16 degrees. Well, yeah, but still, I'll tell you how you can do it.
I can even spin it.
You can spin it. Well, there's a lot of airplanes. Here's how you spin a non-spinnable airplane that has restricted elevator travel. Now, I'm not going to, a guy don't have, I'll just tell you how it is, and that is how it is, and Hagelin and everybody will agree with me. And the guys that are longtime flight instructors will have to agree with it. And here's how you do it. What is your Cherokee stall? 60, 55, 40?
65,
all right, 60.
Flaps,
all right, here's how you do it. You can stall it clean. Here's how you stall it clean. You stand the thing on its tail. Preferably you got 5,000 feet between you and the ground. Because you don't know what's going to happen. You might get it in an inverted spin. You're sitting upside down, spinning like a leaf, like that. So here's what you do. You get as much nose high attitude as possible, right? And you fly it as slow as possible. And then you come in with a tremendous blast of throttle, and it will spin. If it don't.
You can make it spin.
Well, certainly you can.
Poke the old rudder, pull it out of the floor, and
if you feel it bump it to the right for spin over the top, press opposite rudder. Make a snap roll out of it. It'll spin, believe me.
It's good.
Yeah. And then once you're inverted.
I watched one of those last summer.
Oh, yeah.
You went out with two planes, and I'm flying along, with Hal Bergdahl, my instructor. This is before I took my license. And we're tooling along, and one of the other instructors out there was giving a guy who was working on a commercial. Let's go out and we can watch you do these spins. So we're up at about 5,000 feet, and here they are right next to us. We're talking back and forth. And he says, okay, we're going to do a spin now. Straight, straight. Right over here, right next to us. Well,
Well, that was a little hairy for me because I'd never flown that close to an airplane. And we went out there looking for him. And boy, hanging up tight looking for that airplane. Can't see him. That's really weird, boy. I can imagine what it's like fighting fighter planes.
God,
it's hard to see another airplane. Anyway, he pulled that thing up, old Jack pulled her up and rolled her over. Oh, God, the other one. Just like that. Oh, I told Al, man, that just about blew my mind, you know, to watch it. It was worse, probably, watching it than it would have been in the airplane.
Well, anyway, so, you need some acrobat.
Okay.
So, okay, with regard to the crash in the top of the tree, I'm gonna change that a little bit. Clump of trees.
And they were tall boogers. Must have been 150,
right.
60 feet tall.
All I'm saying is I'm going to change that, and I'm going to say in the rewrite that the wing, by the time you were entering those three snap rolls horizontal, it was 40 degrees back, and had the trees not been there, the result would have been totally different, which would probably be totally disastrous.
Yeah.
So I'm going to... All right.
Because chapter 7, page 5, in regard to the Ronca Sedan, which we changed from something else, on the takeoff with Monica's in H.G. Lake, I wanted you to remember that I'd forgotten, it's my fault, to give you the wind factors. I made probably 14 successful landings and 14 successful takeoffs in and out of this whole of the lake, surrounded on the north.
Where the heck is that?
I know. It's east of Chulitna Pass, about 25, 28 miles. East of Chulitna Pass, about 40 ground miles back to Lagoa Creek. But the thing is, the cause, the reason, here's a guy, see, we had 8 airplanes. And I had one 9-passenger job, and like an horse. And how is somebody that's used to flying 8 various configured airplanes going to get in such a stupid trap as to nearly wipe himself and a passenger out? This is the name of the game. What you're trying to do is to gracefully do these things, make money at it, pay off your debts, build better facilities so you can put a better surface, service to your clients, hopefully. Not kill yourself plus clients in the effort, see? This was the theme of the whole thing. And with the about 10 years flying experience, not counting the military treatment, how could anybody be so stupid as to go out there and take off and spin in when you have the background of acrobatics and all the build up that it takes to get through 10 years of flying to start with? So let's clarify that, and we're going to bring the wind factor into it, because it was the wind, the squirrely, turbulent wind boiling over the side of a canyon. I was, hopefully, my previous flight path had been slightly to the left of this canyon and through a low pass. But due to the configurations of the wind and maybe the temperature of the day, the turbulence, in most cases, any plane that I ever got into trouble with has been due to turbulence. And the plane don't perform as specified, and it don't perform as it performed with different temperature and flight and wind conditions, or different load conditions. Getting right back to the density altitude problem. In Mexico, now there's a number of high airfields. There's a lot of people found out with their high-performance airplanes before supercharging arrived, that they could take their Beechcraft Bonanza and go into the 8,000-foot
plateaus of Mexico and wrecked their bonanza on the end of a mile strip on a hot day in Mexico with a density altitude of, instead of 8,000 feet, 14,000 feet. The plane couldn't hack it. The engine didn't have it. The plane wasn't supercharged. And so this is what we're talking about, is a factor. Right, guys? Take beautiful airplanes that cost a lot of money, people with plenty of experience that can fly the airplane hardly without looking. Why should they go out and wipe themselves out? These factors, I make it a point, what takes place and transpires on one takeoff will not necessarily be repeated on the next one. You have to play them all by ear. And the reason
I mentioned density.
Yeah, I know, but it didn't pursue it. That's good, but it didn't pursue it enough. The density altitude that some maiden aunt back in New York, what does that mean to her? Without a little explanation, see?
I thought I'd already explained it.
Well, I maybe so, but a little, what makes planes fly or not fly? Is temperature, the effects of temperature. In brief, temperature effects is one of the great things that affects airplanes, in my experience.
Would it be fair to write that episode then on this tack? Say that Don Sheldon knew about density altitude, obviously. 10 years of flying, you know what density altitude is, what causes the change.
I'm flying a fleet of airplanes
right.
Every day,
okay.
8 of them.
So you know,
and
by the book, all there is to know about density altitude.
Well,
by the book.
If I knew all there was to know, I'd have never started that takeoff.
But
say that.
No, no. But what I'm saying is this. If you had been sitting on the ground before you took that plane off and somebody said, look, if you run into turbulence, is that going to create problems for you on takeoff? Certainly it is. If the air is too hot here, is that going to make problems? Certainly it is. You knew this.
Oh, yeah.
See?
But
it was a combination of factors that was unexpected and did it in.
Well, the thing was...
There's got to be a reason why you spun it. I mean,
well, it's... the reality was far in excess of the expectations. The seriousness of the takeoff was in jeopardy before it even started. Now...
But you didn't realize it, obviously.
Well, no. Not having made more than a dozen trips out of the place in similar conditions, but...
what was different about this particular situation?
Turbulence.
How did it affect the airplane?
Well, it
temperature,
it decreased the performance of the airplane.
Okay.
And would let it fly.
All right.
The wing wouldn't generate the proper amount of lift.
Okay, no problem. We can really rewrite it.
And then the engine wouldn't develop the proper amount of power.
Right. Well, okay.
Yeah, well.
No problem. Rewrite that whole incident. I'll just take those sheets right out, start all over, and rewrite the whole incident.
There's some good parts. You can.
Now this might sound egotistic, but I think the description of what it was like when you start banking that dude around and you cranked her up to 90 degrees and you knew there wasn't any more left.
The thing is, see, the steeper you bank, the faster you stall. You know
right.
that.
Yeah.
All right. But this is a primer type operation. But. I had the option of either flying square. I flew as close as I could to this rock pile. I could either hit it head on or turn a little more away from it. If I turned away from it, I'd spin. I knew I was going to
spin.
Sure you did.
That's why I got ripped.
That's
why I say that part.
I see it's not all bad.
Right.
But I want you to bring out the fact that
there was turbulence involved.
Well, there was more turbulence than expected.
Right.
And probably more temperature than expected.
Okay. You object to the way I write it up from the standpoint of it being a classroom, and that you know this is where you learned a lesson on density altitude. You want me to change that?
Well, no, don't change
again.
It.
Again,
just hit her once lightly
with
the
okay.
wind factor.
Okay.
Explain a little better.
Remember, Don, this rewriting. Mm-hmm. You'll have another go at it.
I know.
In other words, if I miss it this time, we'll get it next time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No problem. So don't worry about it. Okay, let's go on. I pretty well know what you want.
Looky, and another thing, on one of these Bet the Farm takeoffs, that turns in you know.
4, 5, 6 months.
yeah, no, but in the old gambling days of the West, always the farmers would come to town to gamble. There's a farmer and he come to town to gamble. And the next thing he knew, he lost the farm.
The mortgage.
He bet the mortgage, the farm, the cows, the chickens, and he lost the whole potful. Okay. Now, things happen pretty fast. But not that you're not aware of what's happening. But you don't say, now I'm in the 45 degree turn. Now I'm in the 43 degree turn or 46 degree turn. Now I'm approaching the 80 degree turn. Now I'm doing the 90 degree turn. No.
Did I say that?
Well, no, it's as the 90 degree position.
Okay, but that's not saying you knew it.
Oh, I knew
that's
it.
That's just saying, well, all right.
I thought you
just said you didn't know it.
No. You can't call off the numbers as you make these hairy turns.
Well, I know that.
Look, something else happened. That is, when you make a turn, one way to save your bacon is to get the nose down and get the airspeed up. You know that, and I know it. And the longer you fly, the better you better believe it. All right. Okay, now we have a third option. We can hit this square on, we can turn sharper and spin, or we can get the nose down. Now, you know what happened? I spun over the top. I was turning to the left and I spun to the right. You know why? All right. This is profile drag. The fuselage. Listen.
Jesus.
Now, wait a minute.
Okay, I know what you're talking about, but I'm just trying
also, look, how am I going to write this in there? Are in a left-hand turn in certain airplanes and you stall the airplane with the nose up and you stomp on the left rudder. You don't necessarily spin to the left. And here's why. You could very possibly spin to the right because the lowered wing has more lift than the high wing, which is blanketed out by the fuselage, right? Therefore, you don't spin left, you spin right. I spun to the right.
In other words, you're up and around like this, and I want you just like
you do a snap roll to the right. The reason is you completely stall out the high wing. It's on the outside of the circle. It should be flying faster, but the profile drag of the burbel of the fuselage blankets that wing out, and it goes plunk, shoo, pow, and you're in. See, that's what happens on these approach stalls.
Don, what was the sensation like when you saw that work?
Boy, it didn't take long.
Did you remember seeing it?
Oh yeah, man. I looked eyeball to eyeball, straight down, and I say, man, we lost the farm. Plow. And it folded the floats up and jammed the doors closed. Fortunately, it knocked the windshield completely out of
it. Did it hit nose on?
Straight down, rotating to the right. And it tore the
hole. What was it like when it hit?
Just like a dinner gong in a boiler factory. Anyway, it threw Monicus. I had him seated on a quarter of moose meat. Threw him clear up under the panel. This plane had a cockpit as large as a 180 with even a little more room underneath the instrument panel. So anyway, it threw him completely. All I saw of Monicus was one leg sticking up underneath the panel and a moose hind leg sticking up somewhere in the area.
Were you underwater then?
Are you kidding?
It's
only about an inch of the tail of that new bird stuck out.
But I mean, it was a cabin full of water. Did the air hold
it out? Yeah, almost instantly.
I was thinking, you know, standing on its nose, there might be some aircraft.
Oh, no.
I don't.
It blew the whole front of the
I'm airplane being out. Purposely dumb, so that they
yeah, good. No, no, it blew the whole windshield out, right. I think. And,
but the doors were jammed shut by the floats,
yeah,
which were folded up around the outside.
Oh, man, were they ever. They were just molded to the wing. But, anyway, I see this foot sticking in my face, so I got a hold of the foot and wiggled it around and jerked Monicus out, and we took about a 150-foot swim to the bank. The daughter will know how I hauled him. I hooked him under the chin with my left hand, and I swam on my back, and I pulled him to shore.
Well, how, how deep in the water were you?
Oh, well, the plane was within, the plane's 23 feet long, 24 feet long.
Probably 20 feet down.
Only an inch, it stuck out and it wasn't on the bottom.
Their nose was on the bottom.
No.
No, no, that nose.
Just a blue-black lake and it's probably 100 feet deep.
Okay, that explains something. You know, I thought, how in the hell did he have a Cessna for $8,000?
No, this was a fact.
I knew that that was wrong.
A sedan.
But I just left it.
You could buy it for $8,000, which is a lot of money in 1990.
You know what they had in, you know what they had in that Wall Street Journal article? 27 Jeep.
Wait, which one's that? No, that's the Sheep or Yellow Jacket Lake.
You saw that one, 27 G-Lake?
You're doggone right. That cost $27,000.
Well, let's change the name of that chapter then, man.
Well,
good.
No,
8 G-Lake here, 27 G-Lake way down the book.
8 G-Lake is in a different location.
I know it.
80 miles away.
I know it, Don. But the idea is you name these lakes after airplanes you're racked up there.
Yeah. The Yellow Jacket.
So we got this chapter. We got this chapter called 8 G-Lake, right? This one.
Yeah, this is
8
G-Lake.
Now, three, four chapters later, I know it, but three, four chapters later, we come to another chapter, 27
G-Lake.
Over
went up.
Better airplane, higher Andy, see?
Yeah.
So that's, there's a chapter title.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't figure out what they were talking about in that article in there, 27 G-Lake. I thought, geez, maybe the guy just exaggerated a little bit, you know, make it sound
worse.
No,
that's a different.
But that's what you call Yellow Jacket, that little lake
up
there.
That's where we wound up and damaged the sheep farm.
You actually did land the lake there, but...
At
I mean,
27G Lake?
You know, we
did.
I thought you'd hit in a crevasse.
No. On the takeoff from this lake with the sheep hunter and the sheep farm, we destroyed the airplane on takeoff and wound up with the sheep hunter, myself, and the horns in the center section strapped to the seat. 60 feet deep in a big ice hole.
Right, but you weren't in the water like you were at 8G Lake.
No.
Okay.
No, we was out 3/4 of a mile from the lake.
Right.
See?
Okay. But still, you call the lake 27G Lake.
Yeah.
Okay.
Looky, let's knock off this proposition at a 90-degree position. Jesus, nobody was there to measure. Things is happening so fast.
Yeah, but look at that.
At a, rather than 90 degrees, say at a steeper angle. At a, I turn as
you don't know that you weren't at 90 degrees, do you?
Well,
look at. Listen, let me say
better.
Something. I've been listening to all your corrections, and I agree with them wholeheartedly. But look at here's now. Here I got to argue with you. Look at here's some guy. Let's go. Your maiden aunt down in Ohio, sitting there reading this thing. See? She wants to visualize what that airplane's doing. She doesn't want a steeper angle. She wants to know what that cotton picker looks like. She's sitting there, man, what's Sheldon doing now? So, I say 90 degrees. Anybody can understand that, man. Those wings are straight up. You're cranking her around, see? And it doesn't say that you said it was 90 degrees. It just said Sheldon reached the 90-degree point, see? Maybe it was the 85-degree point. Maybe it was 110 degrees. I don't know, see? But that gives the reader an idea of, man, he's standing on one wingtip.
Well, saying that.
All right. It don't make any difference.
Yeah, don't give him
but
a
you
figure.
Didn't know you were standing on one wingtip either,
oh,
really.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
man,
you
I had
you
to get
away
90
from
that rock pile. I'm
yeah. Okay. You got,
see?
We've done that enough. I
let's
right.
Get away from that HP.
And
listen,
no, I know what you want.
On the demonstration of the hand and all, and the insidious buffeting, yeah, true, there was some buffeting.
That's good though, Don. The reason I wanted to do that, because look at, the guy is going to wonder, there again, for non-flyers, people who don't understand, I thought I could give them a little feeling for the idea that after you fly just so long, your hands do it. You haven't got time, you know that, to sit there and say, well, let's see, I'm at 90 degrees, what do I do with the air? You know, that's all I was trying to do there.
Yeah.
You know,
so much harder.
In other words, to indicate that you're automatically flying the airplane by experience.
Yeah, on the same chapter, page 8, manner so rapid that Sheldon had no recollection of its details. Not so. Man, I cussed her all the way to the water, because here I was, fresh out of acrobatics, and I'm spinning into a lake head first. You think I don't know what's going on? You think I have no recollection? You bet I've got a recollection. So, crack that.
Okay, no problem. You wipe it right out.
And
I got enough stuff already. I've already gone. That
the nose didn't go to the left. It went to the right.
Okay, that's on the tape. Don't worry about
spin.
It. Don't worry about it. It's on the tape.
Yeah, okay.
It's right there on those tapes. I'm going to be listening to these tapes as I relay.
Okay.
No problem.
Yeah.
That thing will come through so nice if you just...
Yeah, okay.
No sweat.
Now, how would the passenger realize the trouble was... Well, he knew it was imminent.
Right.
The last part of it, there's no question about that. A fact which probably contributed to his survival. The poor guy got threw up underneath the panel surrounded by moose meat.
Yeah, he did, Don. You know, if he didn't know exactly what had happened, that guy's going to tense up. Maybe he was just extremely lucky. Maybe
he was sitting on a quarter of moose meat and it shot out from under like a cannonball.
Okay.
And he wound up under the panel.
Right.
Period.
Okay. But the thing, the idea I was getting across here, trying to get across, was he's a non-flyer, right?
Yeah, but he's
okay.
Been on many expeditions.
Well, true, but he don't know aerobatics either. He don't know what's going on. All of a sudden, he's just in a confused configuration.
Yeah, but he
hasn't got time to tense up, see? Like the drunk in the automobile accident.
Yeah,
that's what I meant. In other words,
well,
see, that possibly contributed to the fact that he lived.
No, it was just like falling down a cool chute, man. He was just...
Okay.
Listen, he was sitting on, buckled down to this quarter of moose meat we hit so hard.
Was he tied onto it?
Well,
he
was sitting on this slippery quarter of moose meat. For see, with the buckle. And who knows how he got out from underneath the buckle, but certainly the buckle was completely undone. And he was stuffed up under the panel with the rest of the moose meat piece.
Where did you end up in the cockpit? Where were you?
I stayed in my seat.
You were strapped into your seat, I think.
Yeah. Throughout the whole episode.
Well, seat belt saved you.
Yeah.
Shoulder went to it?
No, I didn't have a shoulder harness. It would have
what do you think of these H harnesses?
Fine. Excellent. Yeah, I'd never.
When I buy my airplane, I'm going to have them put in. Can you have those put in a standard stock airplane?
Hey, yeah. I'll tell you what.
Aerobatic type.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you a harness. It's inertia reel.
Well, that's what they got on the one, too. On
yeah.
A chair.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's the dust.
I like these H-harnesses. The regular aerobatic type.
Well, you can. Yeah, they have several styles. One, you just, and it comes undone, and then there's various, early dusters and the super cup. That was pretty good one. I've got one.
Yeah, I know.
And,
I'm going to have one of those put in there, man. That's
oh,
right.
Yeah, but listen, probably break your back, but you won't tear your head off. Going through the panel.
Yeah.
See? And your seat harness shouldn't be anchored to the seat. This is how you break your back. It should be anchored overhead. See? Yeah. Because if you anchor it to the seat and the seat pulls loose your front, this would encourage